Let's get on with it then. It's time. I appreciate you who are here now. Maxine shared the source sheet in the chat, I see. And of course, I will be share screening as we go along. And I want to say that last time we ended on a very high note. We crossed the Dead Sea and we sang, or our subjects did at any rate. Today we're entering a very different kind of era, a different kind of emotional tenor of a story. If last week we discussed crossing the ocean, the week before that we discussed the actual Exodus, big events. Next week we're going to discuss Mount Sinai, another big event. This week we're going to discuss the time in between. And the time in between is very interesting, and as we will see, I hope you will share my feelings about it by the end, very important, but it is not as exciting. It doesn't have grand events, grand momentous revelations. It has revelations, and it has secrets, as we will see very soon. It has quite a few miracles of various sorts, but they're all much smaller scale, and they're all interwoven with the people's sense of confusion and insecurity. And we see this happen, this insecurity take shape and take over their minds pretty much instantaneously. Let's look together at the source sheet. I am here, for those of you who have it open separately, I am here in the first box. Let's catch the tail end of the song, the moment or the tail end of the grand revelation. They started the song. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to God. They said, I will sing to God, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and driver, he has hurtled into the sea. And then they go on and on and on for quite a few verses. And then we hear that Miriam led a dance for the women at the same time. And then they travel away. They leave the ocean. They travel. And immediately they lose confidence. Immediately they don't know exactly how to handle themselves and what they're supposed to do. Let's read the text together. I'm in Exodus 15, starting with verse 23. They came to Marah. Marah means bitter in Hebrew. But they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was named Marah, bitter. Note how the word for bitter repeats itself three times here. In Hebrew, mara, mara, mara. And the water is marim. So four times, really. The root for bitter is four times in one verse. We'll come back to that later. And the people grumbled, or in Hebrew, complained against Moses. In Hebrew, unto Moses, saying, what shall we drink? In Hebrew, the fact that the verb complained is then followed by the connecting word onto or over Moses, kind of conjures this image. It's a very evocative way of putting it. It conjures this image of people piling up onto him. There's one Moses and there's all the people and they're all piling their complaints onto his head. And they say, what shall we drink? So he cried out to God and God showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water and the water became sweet. There God made for them a fixed rule. There they were put to the test. This verse is odd, right? It starts by describing the response to their complaint, namely that the water is bitter. And the response is that once Moshe complains in their name, when Moshe cries to God, he gives him a piece of wood that turns the water sweet. But instead of going on to say, and then they drank and were happy, it adds the idea, sam sham lo chok mishpat. There they put for them laws and commandments, or as they translated it here, made for them a fixed rule. And there God put them to the test. What does that mean? We'll come back to that soon. God said, if you will heed your God diligently, doing what is upright in God's sight, giving ear to God's commandments and keeping all God's laws, then I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am God. I am your healer. Is that the rule? Is that like, is verse 26 an elaboration on the weird sentence here, gave them a fixed rule? Is that the rule he gave them? That if you do my rules, I'm going to protect you from disease? Not so clear. We'll come back to that also. And they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there beside the water. Before we start really unpacking this short and somewhat cryptic, as I hope we saw together now, text, let's look at it in broad perspective. We see a people who literally a few verses ago, and not a very long time ago, saw God drowning their oppressors in the sea. We saw people who were so transported by this experience that they, for the first time since coming out of Egypt, sang, turned their experience into narrative, glorified God. The rabbis say that a slave girl, a maiden girl, saw on the sea, when the sea opened, saw God in a way that Prophet Yechezkel never saw. Yechezkel, who describes in great detail all the things he sees in his revelation and the weird visions, the vision of the chariot, the famous vision of the chariot, even he who saw so much didn't see as much as the simplest of people, not somebody who was very elevated, but just like a girl, uneducated, freshly released from slavery, could see eye to eye when God intervened in history on the ocean, on the Red Sea. And then these people go straight from there to a place of insecurity and complaints. And it's not over. It starts with this event, the event in Marah, where the water is bitter. Then they travel to a new place, and again they complain, oh, if only we could go back to Egypt where we had meat and bread. How, we don't have meat and bread. Hello, this was where they threw your babies into the river, but they're already complaining again. Then they start complaining about that. God gives them the manna, and once again, they don't exactly comply with what God tells them to do regarding the manna. We'll touch upon that later. Then they see the Amalekites attacking them, and they lose heart, and Moshe has to bolster them. Then, once again, they don't have water, and they complain to Moshe about not having water. And thus, they go all the way until the moment when they hit Mount Sinai, from one complaint to the next, to the next, to the next. We who are familiar with the story moving forward know that this is, in a sense, a preview for what will come after. In the end of Shemot and in the beginning, throughout the book of Numbers, we're going to see many, many more cases of complaint. But it's hard to fathom this emotion of not having faith, not having trust in God at this moment in history when you just came out of Egypt and you just saw the miracles and you should be at your highest moment of trust. And the narrative makes it very clear that it's a problem. The narrative, by piling these complaints closely together, by choosing to focus on these moments of complaints, the one exception is the war with Amalek that we'll get to in a bit, but by focusing to that, fill the time between the Exodus and the sea on the one hand and Mount Sinai on the other with one story of complaint after another story of complaint and after another story of complaint, the narrative is giving us a certain version of events that is very unflattering. But at the same time that this version of events stands, and it stands as a certain condemnation or as a certain, not conviction, in court, before you convict someone, you accuse them, right? Indictment, some sort of indictment of look at how unfaithful you are, a moment, how untrusting you are of God, a moment after he saved you. At the same time that the text gives us this official version, in many subtle ways, it invites us to look at it from another angle. It invites us to look at a hidden history, at the reason why this time is important. And the reason that this time is important is that this is the moment when we see the people growing up. We see them rising to some extent. It's not done. It's not over. But rising from a passive group of people being dragged along the desert into people who make choices, who accept consequences, who stand up more on their own two feet than before. We talked a little bit about this theme last week. If you recall, we looked at a letter that John Adams, I'm here at Box 3, wrote to James Warren in April 1776, in which he says, until now, trying to force people to fight for independence wouldn't have worked. They weren't prepared. But now that people are convinced enough that this is necessary, now we have to really start organizing as writing new constitutions, organizing a continental army, et cetera, really coming together to fight the war of independence. And last week we talked about it in the context of why God wanted them to start crossing the sea before he opens it for them, why God needs them to rise up and instead of complaining and expecting God to do it for them, to step in. The problem with that is that this is one moment. And a lot of people can rise to the occasion in moments of high crisis, but it's not the same as rising to the occasion day in and day out to the far less glamorous and yet far more necessary challenge of just taking responsibility for your own life. Think about your teenager children. Think about yourself as teenagers. All these back and forth, all this struggle. I'm sorry, can I just ask to make sure everybody to make sure that they're muted? Thank you. All this struggle to build yourself up to the point that you're not ready to be a hero and save the world. This, I think, most teenagers secretly dream of being able to do already, but rather of doing what today is called adulting. And in many ways, these days that the Jews, the Israelites are spending in the deserts, these few chapters that they're spending in the desert, are the chapters that prepare them to be adults as a people. Especially when you think about the fact that they're coming out of a place of total dependence as slaves on their masters. And now God invites them to make a contract with him, not as slaves, but as partners, not equal to God, but partners. They need to be able to do that. And I want to reread the part we just read and see how God encourages them to do that, to grow up in this passage. But in order to do that, and then in order to go and apply the same question to the other experiences they're going to have, I want to first offer three possible, trajectories of growth that we would like to see happen between Egypt and Mount Sinai, three possible venues in which the people need to grow up and become more than they were before. And I'm taking these venues or these trajectories not from the text, not from the biblical text, I'm taking it from external sources, from things we know about other things, about what it means to grow up and what it means to be people who need to be led somewhere. The first insight or trajectory I want to discuss comes to us from the world of parenting. As parents, we have a very strong urge to make things easy for our children, to make our children have a happy, easy childhood, to make sure they get the prizes they wanted, to make sure they achieve the achievements they wanted. And it creates an insidious and dangerous temptation to remove difficulties from their path. Perhaps it's more a problem of my generation of parents, me as a parent, than it was in previous generations, but it's certainly prevalent enough right now. And a parenting guru I happen to like, Carrie Kampakis, in a beautiful article called Prepare Your Child for the Road, Not the Road for the Child, wrote the following. It's hard not to be a snowplow parent in an age of snowplow parenting. It's hard not to clear every obstacle in our children's path so they can be happy now, getting what they want when they want it, and buck the current trends. But when we clear the road for a child, we make their life too easy. We don't allow them to build life coping skills that need down the road to handle life's hard realities. In other words, childhood and adolescence is the time when we're supposed to learn what it is to fail, what it is to have to try harder, what it is to discover our own limits and have to work really hard to overcome them. And if we don't learn it then, it's very hard to learn later. So this is going to be one trajectory we'll be looking for in the kind of experiences the people experience between the sea and Sinai, namely experiences that inspire them to face difficulty, face privation, face failure, and outgrow it. The second direction I want to offer comes from Aviva Zornberg's commentary, not on this part, but rather on Numbers, on the book of Numbers. She has a beautiful book called Bewilderments. In many ways, the part we're covering today in the book of Exodus is almost like a preview or a foreshadowing of the book of Numbers, because it's all about traveling in the desert and running into difficulties and dealing with them. Of course, if not for the sin of the spies, this would have been it. This part, this short part between Sea and Sinai would have been the bulk of their journey through the desert. They would have got whatever growth they were supposed to get out of it, and they would have been ready for the land of Israel. As we know, it doesn't happen. But what Aviva Zornberg says about the part that happens later very much applies here too. In the book of Wilderness, it is the people who continuously and turbulently speak. God's words are now spoken mostly in response to the people's speech. In the book of the wilderness, Yetziat Mitzrayim, the issuing forth from Egypt, is registered within the subjective consciousness of the Israelites and within their own issues, their troubled utterances. Aviva Zornberg is drawing attention here to the fact that in the book of in big moments of the book of Exodus, God does most of the speaking. Next week, we're going to talk about Sinai, but all the things that God says there. In previous weeks, we talked about everything that God told Moses and the people as they were in Egypt getting ready to leave. All the things God sent Moses to tell Paro over and over and over again. But in order to become a people, it's not enough to be listeners. It's not enough to be receptacles to God's utterances. The people need to find their own voice. Because when God brings them to the land of Israel, God is not going to be hands-on in the way that he was in the Exodus. That's not the way God usually operates in the world. They need to be able to continue on their own. And for that, they need to develop speech, to develop self-expression, to develop, if you will, and this is something that I, as a mother of children on the edge of adolescence, feel very strongly, a sense of initiative. I find it one of the hardest things to encourage in children. You can encourage good manners by insisting on them. You can encourage good habits by making it a rule. But all the boundaries in the world are not going to help you if what you want to encourage is creativity and initiative. To the contrary, it can limit initiative and creativity. And I find it an ongoing challenge to try and inspire my children or invite them to lead their own forays into the world, their own forays into what they want to be. And in a sense, this is what God needs to leave room for in this time in the wilderness. And if you think about it, the wilderness is a very, I'm sorry, can everybody make sure they're muted? Thank you. In a sense, a wilderness is the right place for it because it's empty. It invites, it gives room. God needs to make room for them to speak up. So this is the second trajectory we're going to be looking for, the development of the people's speech, of the people's ability to speak up. The third has to do with a realm we didn't discuss yet. It has less to do with how you handle challenges, because challenges still come to you from the outside, and less to do with what you say, and much more with what you feel. And in order to explain what I mean by that, I want to bring a quote from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, High Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zichrono Levracha, in an article that he wrote about the war against Amalek. Just to recoup, in the war against Amalek, Moses stands on a rock, and whenever Moses' hands are raised, the people are winning. Whenever he's too tired and puts them down, they're losing, until Hur and Aharon hold his hands up for him. And the rabbis immediately ask, what? It's magic? When Moshe's hand is up, they win, they down, they lose. No, it's a reminder. When they see Moses with his hands up, they think about God and their faith brings them victory. So talking about that, Rabbi Sacks writes the following. A fundamental principle of leadership is being taught here. A leader must empower the team. They cannot always do the work for the group. They must do it for themselves. But the leader must, at the same time, give them the absolute confidence that they can do it and succeed. The leader is responsible for their mood and morale. In today's terminology, a leader needs emotional intelligence. Daniel Goleman, best known for his work in this field, argues that one of the most important tasks of a leader is to shape and lift the mood of the team. Great leaders move us. They ignite our passions and inspire the best in us. When we try to explain why they are so effective, we speak of strategy, vision, of powerful ideas, but the reality is much more primal. Great leadership works through the emotions. For the people of Israel to be able to reach Mount Sinai and not stand there as the subjects of the King of Kings, passively dragged along for the journey, but rather as people in their own rights, mature enough and responsible enough and capable enough to accept the covenant and work with it as equals, as real leaders in their own right, not enough that they will have good hope. Not enough that they will have. It's very difficult. Please make sure you're everybody. It's very hard to stand up. Don't also have. Can everybody just take a second and make sure that they're muted, please? Thank you. I can't. I don't know how to mute everyone. I'm sorry. I don't. Usually Maxine is here to help me with that, but I don't know how to do that. I'll try. Mute all. That's it. Okay. Let's continue. Can you hear me? Please nod. Okay. Thank you. I didn't mute myself by mistake. Okay. That's very good. That would somewhat defeat the purpose. Either way, in order to stand as equals in Sinai, they also need to have a feeling of self-confidence. They need to believe in themselves. And this is a level of emotional maturation, of emotional growth that no one can force on you. People can invite you or encourage you to reach it, but they can't force it onto you. And this is another trajectory we're going to be looking for. So without further ado, let's go back to the passage we read earlier about the very first moment of difficulty and see how God and the people handle, or God tries to help them handle, all those three trajectories. I'll repeat what they are. One is dealing with difficulties, not preparing the road, but rather preparing your child for the road. One is initiative and speech, and one is emotional maturation, confidence. Let's start again. They came to Marah, but they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was named Marah. So already here, we see that God listens to parenting advice, so to speak, and does not prepare the road for the children. He allows them to run into difficulty. In fact, it's so odd. It's such a notable thing that God allows them to run into bitter water that the rabbis ask, wait a minute. When a king or a leader prepares their army for a march, they take care of their supply in advance. If you don't take care of their supply in advance, you're going to fail. How can it be that the King of Kings doesn't prepare supplies in advance? Why can't the water be already sweet when they reach there? It's God. He can do whatever he wants, right? And they say, no, it's on purpose, so that they would have the experience of privation, the experience of coming there and finding that the water is bitter and that they don't have drink. And then God will turn it into sweet water for them. And then next time they will have more trust in God and they'll be less frantic when they run into difficulty. They need to learn to live with these kinds of privations, with these kinds of challenges. So we see here both how God allows them to face difficulty And also we see some of the third trajectory here, namely helping them to develop a sense of confidence, a sense of trust, a sense of they can do it. It's a doable achievement. But we didn't see yet how speech comes into the picture. So let's go, keep going with verse 24. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And here the rabbis again say something very astounding, the commentators. They say, this is not even a real complaint. Later, and we will get to that part soon, when they complain about being hungry, they really phrase it as a complaint. They say, oh, if only we could be back in Egypt. If only we had the meat and food in Egypt. Here, they're asking a question. It's described as grumbling, as crowding on Moses, and perhaps expressing that right now they're still not in a place of confidence. They still need to build that confidence. But despite being frantic, despite piling onto him with their concerns, the question is actually very, very polite, very objective. What should we drink? You are our leader. Tell us, what should we drink? And here God does something beautiful, because God doesn't say, do like this, snap your fingers, and make the water sweet. God says, take a piece of wood and throw it into the water and it'll become sweet. And the rabbis immediately say, that doesn't make any sense. Why do it this way? Why take a piece of wood, and presumably it's a bitter wood also if it grew out of this water, and throw it into something bitter? Why would one bitter, unedible thing touching another bitter and unedible thing produce something drinkable, potable? Why do you need both? And they say this is the miracle. But I say it's not just a miracle. It's not just highlighting that there's something unnatural happening here. It's also helping them by inspiring them, namely trajectory number three. Because when the people see all this bitterness transformed into sweetness, might it not remind them of their own bitterness of heart, of their own bitterness of experience, the bitterness that we still remember every year when we eat marvel, a bitter vegetable in the night of the Seder, the bitterness of enslavement, the bitterness of hard work in Egypt? And when they see how bitterness can become sweetness, much as when we dip the bitter vegetable in the sweet charoset, they are given hope that their own life experience can transform through them into something wonderful. That they, the carriers of this trauma, this incredible trauma, this incredible bitterness, can become more than that. Sima Hertzberg is asking a very good question in the chat that is actually important to address right now. She's asking, but the term the text uses, ba'ilonu, which means complained rather than vaishalu, asks, so wasn't it a complaint? I agree. I think it was both. It is a complaint. They are expressing a sense of distress, a sense of this is not okay, a sense of God, what is happening here? But the way they're phrasing it is also showing a level of restraint, a level of trust. They're giving us an inkling that they might not be there yet. They're not fully trustful. They're not fully confident, but they have it in them to grow. They have it in them to learn. They're not immediately spilling all their worries all over the place and complaining. They're asking a question that's a legitimate question. What should we drink? This shows a certain level of self-mastery that shows that to some extent they're liberated from impulse, which is a very important step of growing up, being liberated, growing free from impulse. And then we come to that weird enigmatic verse where God doesn't simply make it sweet. He also made them a fixed rule. There they were put to the test. Or in Hebrew, sham lo, chok u'mishpat. There he gave them laws and commandments and he tried them, put them to the test. And interestingly, the rabbis say that the law that he gives them here is not just what he says in the next verse, namely, if you will heed your God diligently, doing what is upright in God's sight, getting, etc., etc., I will not bring you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, but rather that he gave them some actual laws, Let's see it together in Rashi. I'm moving on to box number two. Here he made for them a statue and an ordinance. Et Marah, he gave them a few sections of the Torah in order that they might engage in the study thereof, vis-a-vis the sections containing the command regarding the Sabbath, the red heifer, and the administration of justice. This follows a very ancient tradition that considers the psychological state of the Israelites. They just left a place that was entirely horrible, but had some certainties. There was the certainty of the master's will, the certainty that you have to do what the master tells you. There was a certainty of the lash, of what happens if you don't do it. There was a certainty that as long as you're serviceable and usable, they might preserve your life. There was a certainty of punishment. These are not pleasant certainties, but they're very strong and total certainties. And then within all of that, the people know how to live. Suddenly they're thrown into freedom. They have no idea what they're supposed to do with themselves. And when they come to Moses and God and say, what should we drink? God looks at it and says, okay, you can't quite figure everything out by yourself. I'm going to give you a symbol. I'm going to give you a miracle that will give you hope and confidence in me and in Moses and in yourself, hopefully, eventually. But I will also give you some boundaries and guidance that will help you not feel so lost. And know that just like parents don't tell their children all the rules that a person has to follow from the moment they're three, but rather you introduce certain rules, like don't run to the road, don't touch fire, and then later you add more rules and more rules. Just like children are not expected to follow all the rules of the Torah from the moment they're born, so God is not giving them all his laws. They're not ready for it. He's first letting them experiment with a few. He's letting them experience it. He's letting them try it out for size. See what it's like to have laws that you need to follow, that you maybe want to rebel against. Can you control that impulse, etc. Inviting them to start balancing between their own will and their own life and expectations that are not as oppressive as the ones they're used to from Egypt. Now, of course, Rashi's interpretation here, even though it's following a very old Midrashic tradition, is not the only interpretation. It's not the only answer to the question of what kind of laws God is giving them. Ramban, in his interpretation, is offering two other options. One is that God isn't giving them laws, but rather he's giving them a preview, a trailer of the laws to come. He tells them, you don't have to do it yet, but in the future, I will command you to do A, Y, Z. I'm going to read here from the middle. He's saying, in the future, the Holy One, blessed be he, will command you so, in the same way as Abraham, our father, learned the Torah. The purpose of it was to make them familiar with the commandments and to know if they would accept them with joyfulness and with gladness of heart. This was the trial of which Scripture says, and there he tried them. In other words, the point here, unlike in Rashi's explanation, is less to work with boundaries. It's more to work with ideas. And there the question is less, are you going to comply? How are you going to apply it in your own life? But rather, are you going to find joy in contemplating these ideas? Are you going to be able to, looking at them, seeing them a source of self-determination, or are you going to be like a little kid being dragged to school to his great chagrin? Then Ramban offers another answer, namely that it wasn't the Torah laws at all that God offered them there. It wasn't, I apologize for the noise here, there are children in the house. I hope it's not too loud for you. God didn't offer them specific Torah instructions like Shabbat or something like that, but rather basic social rules for how to live together. Because until now, all the rules stem from Egypt. All the rules stem from what the Egyptians' masters tell you to do. Now that they're traveling as a group in the desert, it's not enough that God and Moses feeds them. They need to not walk into each other's bedrooms, for example, not take each other's things. They need to ration their water. They need to ration their food. So God gives them rules like that, some guidance that's more kind of like wilderness education. on how to be a society. And they need to get used to that before they can accept the particular laws of the people of Israel. They need to be a people before they can be a people of Israel. One way or another, at the end of, no matter how you understand the specific laws, what we see is that God is allowing them to face difficulty, which speaks to the first trajectory we mentioned, the learning how to deal with life, waits until they speak up and come to him with the question, then offers them a miracle that inspires them and gives them some boundaries to work with as they move forward. All of that happens again in a much more complicated way a few verses later when they come to him with a new complaint. Let's look at it together. I am in box 4 here, Exodus 16, verses 1 to 3. Setting out from Elim, the whole Israelite community came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. In the wilderness, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of God in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots, when we ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to starve this whole congregation to death." This is a much harsher complaint already. This is no longer the mild, "What should we drink?" that we heard before. This is a fully pledged grumbling, something to remind us that sometimes the process of growth is not linear. It's not that you always get better or more mature. Sometimes you have bursts of maturity and then you regress and then you burst forward. And as long as you eventually reach the point of growth you need to get to, it's fine. But we see that happen here. We see how farther away from Egypt they're less kind and their complaints. But there's more than that. As the commentators know, this very particular language, when they talk about sitting on the pot of flesh, the pot of meat, tells us something specific about the people making this complaint. And different commentators deduce different things. Or Chaim deduces the following, I'm here on the source sheet. This verse clearly shows that the people who uttered the slander were not the ones who had performed slave labor, but had been overseers. The laborers had never had anything to eat but unleavened bread. Possibly the speakers were the well-known Datan and Aviram, these two nasty people who will later challenge Moses in the case of Korach, and then are blamed by the rabbis for almost every murmuring before and after, before, not after, who were known for their wickedness. Whether or not you accept what Or HaChaim says here, namely that it's not all the people saying that, but rather the people at the forefront, the people framing this complaint, are the people who were chosen to be like the overseers of the slaves, whether you accept it or not, he is drawing our attention to a very important fact, that when we talk about the adolescence of the people and the growth of the people, it's very important to remember, namely that they're not a homogeneous group. The Israelites have not all had the exact same experience at this point. Some of them were at the bottom of the rung. They were the real laborers. Some of them received some privileges in return for overseeing the labor of their brothers and sisters. Recall how Moses ended up running away from Egypt because he saw two Jews fighting, and it's pretty clear that those Jews are not in the position of total servitude. There's clearly some stratification within the Jewish people. For that matter, let's talk about gender. The experience of women in Egypt and men in Egypt was not the same at all. The experience of people who were older and lived through different stages of the subjugation was not the same as people who grew up, were born relatively late and experienced only the last bitter years and didn't see how it gradually became worse and worse. And somehow Moses and God want this varied group of people, all of them carrying trauma, but not all the same trauma, and presumably some of them carrying resentments against each other, to become one people, which adds a whole other layer of complexity to the project we're watching evolve, because they're not just trying to become more independent. They also have to learn how to be with one another. Another commentator, Ha'amek Davar, I don't have it in English, I'll just translate it for you here, looks at the same verse and learns something different from it. He says, when you're a slave, you don't have your own animals that you then slay and cook and eat. Your masters have the food. They have the means of production. They have the food. And they make some stew or something and serve it to you when they so wish. And while it means that you're totally dependent on them, it also means that you never have to make the calculation of, should I kill this cow now or wait for a month so that I'll have meat later? Do I have enough goats that I can kill one now, or should I keep them for milk? Do I have enough sheep that I can kill one now because I feel like eating meat, I'm hungry? Or should I wait until my baby is born in 3 months? Or maybe if I kill the sheep, they're not going to breed and I'm not going to have milk later for the baby, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have to deal with all these questions of husbandry, of dealing with your own property. When you're a slave and you eat what you're given when you're given it, and it's terrible, but you don't have to make any decisions in that case. In other words, when the people are coming and saying, we want bread, we want meat like we had in Egypt, to some extent, the subconscious desire they're expressing is, in a sense, the infantile desire to be spoon-fed, not to have to make these kinds of decisions, not to have to take responsibility. And Ha'amek Davar there in the Hebrew, you can see it later yourself if you want, even makes a comment about that, that now that they have animals, they didn't have property before. Now that the animals, they don't want to kill them. They want to keep them. It reminds me a little bit of how my family is from the Soviet Union. When my uncle moved from the Soviet Union to America, the first time he went to the supermarket, first of all,
Hello?
He was totally lost in the plenty. And secondly, he went and bought a few frozen chickens and put them in his freezer. And he never ate them, but he wanted to have it. He wanted to have these chickens to feel safe. Suddenly, these slaves are coming out and they have food and they don't want to give it up. They don't want to suddenly kill the animals they just got. They want to keep it for a rainy day. And where is the master? Where is the overseer to spoon feed me food? And into that moment of doubt and perhaps social tension and definitely unfair complaints and somewhat subconscious or conscious desire for passivity, step God and Moses and offer a type of bread that forces the people on a regular basis to learn how to do the juggling act between dependence and independence, initiative and acceptance, trust and forethought. And that is the man, the manna, a food that at the same time keeps them totally dependent on God and forces them to trust God, but also invites them to develop that sense of trust since every day they're fed. And they can develop a sense of confidence in it. They no longer need the freezer chickens to give them a sense of confidence. But at the same time, it's a food that requires their active participation. I would like to read that part, the part about the manna, the text about the manna, and note those places where we see God inviting them to take initiative, to speak up, to deal with difficulties, and inspiring them to develop confidence. All the three trajectories we discussed earlier. I am in books number 7. God spoke to Moses. I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Note that it starts with their speech. They're invited to speak and shape reality. Speak to them and say, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. When the fall of dew lifted there over the surface of the wilderness lay a fine and flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, Manhu, meaning what is it? For they did not know what it was. Note that God names the food we're going to accept their name for the food, named after a question. This is the food that's supposed to invite a question. It's supposed to invite them speaking up and inquiring and engaging their own curiosity. I'm going to pause here for a moment and read something that Aviva Zornberg wrote about it. I'm going a little bit far up on the page. The skeptical question, manhu, what is it, gives its name to the mana. It is the question, not the answer, that names the unknowable substance. This mana, this what stuff, remains enigmatic. It may be a source of sensual variety and pleasure, but at the same time, it remains ungratifying, imaginatively indigestible. The 40-year Midbar journey was intended as a difficult odyssey of self-understanding, a reconnaissance mission into the human heart. In other words, since they didn't grow enough, they didn't discover themselves as independent people enough in this chapters that we're reading now, they're going to have to do it again in the desert for 40 years. The mana is essential wilderness food, precisely in its unknowability. It'll open a new kind of knowledge. The mana is an intimate encounter with the otherness that issues from God's mouth. Just like God's words inspire them to see something beyond themselves, so does God's food inspire them to think beyond what they know and see. A substance that tells of the unknown leads the consumer to see through its flimsy appearance. This is the essential midbar experience, desert experience. The unknowable leads the traveler to an imaginative knowledge, which refigures, transfigures the world. In other words, if God had said, okay, sure, here, I'm going to rain loaves of bread or matzot at you, they would just accept it. It will be just bread. By giving them something that is a weird substance, and to this day, we're not sure exactly what it was like, God invites them to constantly ponder the limits of what they know and go beyond that, thus inviting growth from them in both imagination and speech and development of ideas. I'm going to go back now to box 7, to the text itself. I am going to read in verse 19. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over until morning. Once again, Moses gives them a boundary, a rule, an opportunity to trust God, but also follow God. Not just trust that he will feed you, but also trust that translates into actions. And at first they fail, but they paid no attention to Moses. Some of them left of it until morning. Again, think about my uncle and his frozen chickens, right? They finally, they're given food. They're not going to let it go so fast. And it became infested with maggots and stunk. And Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning as much as each one needed to eat, for when the sun grew hot, it would melt. So they have an experience. They fail and they learn from it. They learn not to do it again. They learn it's unneeded and useless. Just like parents letting their children fail first and then grow better instead of removing the boundary to begin with. And then there's a shift. Up here at verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered double the amount of food, 2 omers for each. And when all the chieftains of the community came and told Moses, and here I want to pause and say that according to the rabbis, they came to tell it to him as a matter of concern. They said, oh no, the people are doing it again. They're collecting more than they should. We thought they learned their lesson, but they didn't learn their lesson. Except that now we'll find out that actually this is a proof that they did learn. Because they learned that it's important to listen to God both when he says, stop collecting, and when he says, collect double. He said to them, Moses tells to the leaders of the community, chief stands, this is what God meant. Tomorrow is a day of rest, a holy Sabbath of God. Bake what you would bake and boil what you would boil, and all that is left put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered, and it did not turn foul, and there was no maggots in it. Once again, we see how living with the man invites them to balance out dependence and independence. The food is given to them, but they have to go and collect it, and they have to collect it in the right way and in the right amount. Sometimes the right amount is for one day, sometimes the right amount is for 2 days. They have to keep track and make it happen. And if they fail, God doesn't kill them. God doesn't rain fire on them. The food goes bad, or they don't have enough food for the next day. They are getting natural consequences that are appropriate to the mistake, thus being pushed to develop both their ability to handle the situation and their sense of confidence in God and in themselves. I want to continue here. I am in box. I'm in. Let's start again with verse 24. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses ordered, and it did not turn foul, and there were no maggots in it. Then Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is the Sabbath of God. You will not find it today on the plain. 6 days you shall gather it. On the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none." Yet some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found nothing. Again, people are experimenting, like children, looking at the boundaries you give them and stepping just a toe over them to see how you respond. So the people. And God said to Moses, "How long will you all refuse to obey my commandments and my teachings? Mark that it is God who, having given you the Sabbath, therefore gives you 2 days' food on the sixth day. Let everyone remain in place. Let no one leave the vicinity on the seventh day." So the people remained inactive on the seventh day. I want to pause here again and point out that now God expects from them inactivity. Until now, God asked them to act. Now God asked them not to act. But this inactivity is very different from the inactivity of a slave expecting orders. This is an inactivity they have to choose and prepare for by collecting double on the sixth day. In other words, they have to make this island of time, of inactivity for themselves. And in a sense, this is an even fuller challenge to their own sense of liberty, to their own sense of agency, of initiative, than the activity is, because it's telling them, can you be free enough from impulse, from fear, from your slave habits, not only to do what God tells you, not only to trust in him, not only to be proactive in your relationships with one another and manage your society well, but also free enough to be able to say, I'm letting go now. Right now, I'm sitting back. It's no wonder that the Sabbath is such a central commandment that it deserves being given to us before we even make it to Sinai. Because in many ways, the Sabbath is the antithesis of what it was to be a slave in Egypt. In Egypt, you don't control your actions. You don't control when you're active and when you're inactive. You're doing what the master tells you. You have to. You have to act to fill the quota. Until you fill the quota, you can't rest. The Sabbath means that you are a master to yourself enough that you can let go of work. You don't need to spend every moment of your waking life looking for sustenance or following orders from a master or running around and doing activities. You can afford to let go. You can plan ahead enough to make it possible by collecting the food you need and setting the hot water urn, the plata, and whatever we do in the modern time to make it happen. In other words, you are a master of your time and of your plans and of the way the future is managed through your actions in the present. And so God gives them the Sabbath and gives them the manna and gives them this daily opportunity to work their way through challenges, to take initiative in the right way, to come to trust God and also trust themselves. And he turns it into their way of life. He takes all these lessons that they need to learn and makes it a daily experience for them and a weekly experience in the case of Shabbat. But the difficulties are not over. And the next difficulty comes from without. The next difficulty comes not when they're complaining, but rather, they do complain one more time. They complain about not having water, and Moses hits the rock and gives them water. I didn't bring it here because we already talked so much about complaints. After the water, The next challenge comes from without, from Amalek, this nation that comes and attacks them out of the blue. And before we read what we have in the text about Amalek, I want to speak about a Midrashic tradition we have that asks, when does Amalek come and attack us? Amalek is like the villain for us, right? More than Egypt, in a sense. Because Egypt, we're done with. We have special commandments for the king not to take us back to Egypt by collecting too much money, too many wives, or too many horses, and becoming like Egypt or taking us back to Egypt, but we're done with it. Amalek, we're given a commandment to keep eradicating them throughout history. And the rabbis look at the moments when Amalek makes an appearance. Amalek makes an appearance when we came out of Egypt and we started getting our confidence and we went through all these experiences of complaint and we started advancing in all these trajectories. We describe the trajectory of dealing with difficulties, of speech and initiative, of being inspired and stronger emotionally and more confident. And we're about to hit Mount Sinai and get the Torah. And then at the moment when we already achieved so much and we're on the brink of success, Amalek come and challenge us. When does Amalek come back in history? It comes in the rule of the first Jewish king. We go through, I'm sorry that I'm jumping so far ahead in the Bible, but it's important to put it in perspective here. We go through the era of the judges. We start coming together as a people instead of as the scattered tribes with great difficulty. It's very difficult. King Shaul comes and rises, and at first the people don't trust him. He has to prove himself in battle for them to trust him. And they start trusting him, and they start coming together. And there's a king who's a noble man, a beautiful, humble, noble man. And he has a son who's a wonderful guy. We already know him at this point of the story as a righteous warrior in his own right. And it looks like there's going to be a dynasty that's going to lead us forward into an era of peace and prosperity. And then King Shaul is ordered to kill all the Amalekites and does it. Again, on the cusp of success. And the question is why? What is Amalek supposed to teach us? Why is Amalek always appearing in the place where we're almost on the brink of success? And one of the answers I heard from a friend of mine, actually, Yael Unterman, was that perhaps Amalek is, in a sense, a representation of something that's very real in processes of growth in general, namely the fear of success. When we work hard to become very good at something and succeed at something, that moment when we're on the cusp of bringing everything together, of making it all work, we might get cold feet. We might fear maybe we'll fail. Maybe if we now try and fail, it's going to be devastating. So maybe we shouldn't try. We should retreat. We should hem and haw. We should not complete the project. There's a certain sense that growth is difficult. Growth, as we've discussed today, requires a lot from you and requires comfort with the unknown and uncertainty and working on your emotions and trying to take initiative and then failing and dealing with it. But we know how to do that. We people, we live in the flux. Success is its own kind of challenge. Success, there's some finality to it that is scary in and of itself. And it is here, in that moment of the challenge right before they reach Sinai, that Moshe teaches them the special thing by raising his hands to help them fight against Amalek. So obviously he's helping them fight against a physical enemy in a real moment in history. But perhaps he's also inspiring all of us throughout history to remember something. To remember that in success also, we need to have faith. Completing the process also requires faith, requires self-confidence, requires remembering why we're here and what we're doing. And when Moses raises his hands, moment, I'll open it in the source sheet. When Moses raises his hands, I'm in verse 11, Israel prevails. When we look up in all of our separate lives, not just in that moment in history, when we look up and remember what it is that we're fighting for, what it is that we're rising to, then we have the courage not only to strive to be better, but also to complete the process of growth and stand up and be what we need to be at the end of it. And it is very fitting that they have to go through this experience before coming to Mount Sinai, because Mount Sinai is meant to be that moment of success. It's meant to be that moment when they take everything they learned, they take all their emotions and initiative and speech and skills in handling difficulties, and bring everything they are into a covenant with God. Next week, we will discuss it at length and see whether that actually happens and how it happens. And the week after that, we will see that, in fact, the growth is incomplete and they have quite a lot more learning to do before they can really rise to the covenant itself. I have another thought I'd like to share for those who can stay. But first, I'll look at some of your questions. Moment. Lidna Hepner wrote, when they complain in Egypt, Pharaoh imposed more work on them. When they complain as free people, God gives them Torah to study, laws, philosophies, and rituals of their very own as a people. That's very beautiful. And it also reminds me, puts me in mind of something a psychologist friend once told me, which is that when children complain, you can punish them for complaining, but you're only killing their initiative. They're not going to come and talk to you next time they need something or want something. And sometimes you really want them to talk to you and know what's bothering them. Whereas if you give them a challenge, they're very likely to want to rise to it, no matter how negative their attitude is in the start. Sima Hertzberg, in relation to Orach Chaim, writes, perhaps the Orach Chaim, I assume you mean the part where he talks about how it must have been the overseers complaining, is drawing on the phrase Vayomru Elehem Bnei Israel, and the Israelites told them, as opposed to the earlier Kol Adat Bnei Israel, omission of Kol. Correct. That is, in fact, what he draws on, very well spotted, namely that the beginning of the verse, it says, all of the Israelites came to complain, but then the complaint itself is attributed to one person or to a smaller group without the call. The call that everybody is dropped. Nomi Bariam wrote, I'm trying to imagine collecting just enough man, each day for growing family. We don't eat the same amount each day, growing children even more so. So one of the things it says on the parts I didn't bring was a part of the miracle of the man was that no matter how much you collected, it was the right amount. In a sense, it like balanced itself out. If you collected a little bit too much, it wasn't too much. If you collected a little bit too little, it balanced out. There's something about this that was fluid. It was not a fixed food in the way that, say, bread from the store is fixed. I have to say, as a mother, it sounds very appealing. I agree with you. Feeding a growing family can be a big headache. So it sounds kind of nice to just go to God's buffet and take some food and know that it'll be enough. Suri Rudolph wrote, Paro denied them a Shabbat. In Exodus 5:5, he objects to Moses' request by saying, the people are numerous. Do you expect me to allow them to rest from their toils? Ve'ishbatem otam mi'sivlotam? Correct. So it's like the opposite. It's like he's giving them what Peor refused to give them.
The use of the same word, the Shabbat, ve'ishbatem.
Mm-hmm.
He takes
right Shabbat, Ishbatim, right? Like the kind of in modern Hebrew we use it also for a strike, which is very appropriate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Annie Garmaz, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, wrote, it is not that the water is bitter, it is they who still have the bitterness of their life in their spirits, and they need Hashem to help them change their attitude as they move through the desert step by step. That's very well put, Annie. Thank you for putting it this way. I wouldn't say it's not bitter. The water, I mean, text is very clear that it is bitter, literally, but I agree that it's an allegory, an invitation to look at it as something beyond that. Okay, so on that note, thank you to everybody for your questions. I'll just share a very quick thought for those of you still here. When we read Parashat Itro and show the parsha where we receive the Torah, there's always the question, why do we start with Itro? Right? Why do we start with the arrival of Moshe's father-in-law Itro and the advice he gives Moshe about how to delegate his judicial job, judicial responsibility? Itro looks out and sees how Moses every day sits and everybody comes to them with their judicial questions, and he answers all their questions, and he says, this is not fair for you or for them. You should appoint a group of people who each of them will be responsible for 10. And then above them, 10% of that will be responsible for those. And build a justice system where a person first goes to one person, and then if that person doesn't know, goes to a more high up person. And only if the highest up people don't know the answer, they come to you. And the question is, why do we need that part right before receiving the Torah? Shouldn't receiving the Torah be its own parsha? Why do we include that? I think that in light of everything we saw today, we actually can understand that better. Why, before we receive the Torah, we have that weird intervention by Itro, who of course comes from being some sort of leader in Midian, so has more administrative experience than Moses at this point, and being an established administrator in an established society. What Yitro offers to Moshe is to empower the people themselves, to build a system in place that empowers the people to be part of their own governance. He's not telling him, replace yourself, abdicate. He's telling him, you don't need to do everything yourself. It's not going to work long term. If you want society to work, you need people to take positions within the society and help you. And in a way, coming kind of out of left field, out of Midian, so to speak, this advice is the culmination of the psychological process that we saw God and Moses leading the people through until this moment. They're trying to encourage the people to speak up, to trust, to experiment, to participate, to take initiative within reasonable boundaries, to experiment with some of the laws, et cetera, et cetera. And now Itro tells them, okay, now make it official. Don't just do it by making them experience things. Turn it into an official system that allows them to be part of their own governance and allows you to manage a society that you would not be able to manage otherwise, not for very long. And it's beautiful to finish on this note right before we get the official law, to know that we are prepared for it, not only to some extent emotionally through our process of growth, but also officially, or in the way we arrange ourselves, by having in place a way to manage under the law that God is about to offer us. And on that note, I'm going to say goodbye and have a lovely rest of the day and rest of the week. And thank you very much for coming. And I'm looking forward to reaching Sinai with you next week. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.